The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good morning. So for the last few weeks, we've been talking about emotions, and last week we started talking about a kind of the emotional map of the heart that is starting to wake up, the heart that is starting to open and connect with experience. Often when we think of the emotions that are common in our day-to-day lives, they are the emotions of struggle, of difficulty. And even those emotions that we typically think of as good emotions, like excitement and love, our typical kind of love, they often have some clinging, some tightness, some tension to them. So in this discussion around this, the heart that's open, the emotions that are happening in the heart that is open and connected? And last week I started talking about that and exploring particularly four qualities, four emotions that happen, that they are both cultivated as we practice, that are, as our heart opens through the practice of connecting with our experience, these qualities are cultivated, and they are kind of the natural result of our heart as it lets go of greed, aversion, and delusion. So they're both a way of practicing, and they are a natural result. And these four in particular that I'd like to go into a little more discussion of today are the quality of loving kindness, of metta, the Pali metta, of compassion, karuna is the Pali for that, of sympathetic joy, the Pali for that is mudita, and equanimity, upekkha. So we talked a little bit about these last week, but what I'd kind of like to explore today is two sides. One, how do these qualities feel? You get a sense of what they are about. And exploring some ways to practice with them, to cultivate them. So the three of these qualities, the kindness, compassion, and joy, are very intimately connected. Essentially, they are related to this capacity for the heart to be open and meet our experience without resistance and without desire. So without either wanting to hold on to something or wanting to get rid of something. So these three qualities are about what it means to meet experience without either the pushing away of aversion or the holding on to of greed. And the connecting with experiences is the absence of the delusion. When we're deluded, we're often just kind of in a cloud and a fog. We're not really meeting experience as it is. So the open heart that meets experience is the quality of kindness, of metta. It's the meeting of experience when there's not particularly anything much, either positive or negative happening. So for instance, just think about how it feels or how it might feel when you see a dear friend that you haven't seen for a very long time. Just reflect on that for a moment. What's the quality, if you can envision that in your mind, what's the quality in the heart of that. So it's the feeling of well-wishing. I hope that you're happy. I hope that you're healthy. I hope your family is safe and that all is well with you. So that's the wish of kindness, the wish of metta. It doesn't need anything back, this quality of metta. It's just an outpouring of well-wishing. No need for them to do anything or respond in any particular way, just simply that open, connected feeling. Now, in my own experience of exploring my relationship to metta, I discovered that when I first started touching into this quality of well-wishing, of wishing happiness for someone, of wishing that they be healthy and safe, I noticed that I had this kind of holding back, because it felt to me that happiness was a zero-sum game, and that if I was wishing for somebody else to be happy, that it meant that I would be less happy. So that's something to keep an eye out for in this movement of opening the heart. Is there a little bit of holding back? It's like, if I hope they're happy, well... So noticing that would not be the purity of metta, to have that kind of little twist to it. Also, I mean, so there's the two sides of that not quite purity of metta. One is that wishing that they're happy I'll hope that you're happy if you'll do something for me, or I'll love you if you'll love me back. So there's that aspect of it, the needing something back, and there's the kind of fear that wishing somebody else happiness means that I won't be happy. So this quality of metta, just this feeling of just openness, of just well-wishing, moving outwards without needing anything back. And in a way, we can wish this for ourselves. I mean, we can wish this for ourselves. That it's very natural to wish that ourselves be happy. Just make that, have that wish for ourselves to be happy. I do find that the quality of metta kind of naturally wants to move outward. So that in practicing and cultivating this quality, it starts to feel a little funny if it's just directed inward all the time. So it has a natural movement outward. There's a natural expression outward. And I find, too, in my own experience, that the more I feel this sense of kindness towards myself, the easier it is for it to move outwards. When that quality of that open-heartedness, that just being able to meet without resistance or wanting, when it meets a situation where there's suffering, it turns into compassion. So that open heart, when it meets suffering, naturally responds with this emotion of compassion. Now, it feels somewhat different than the feeling of kindness, because it's meeting a given situation where there's something happening that seems off or seems painful. So I tried to think of an example for this where, because often when we meet suffering, there's some kind of resistance to that suffering. There's a sense that or a sense of aversion to the suffering that may either manifest if you're seeing somebody else suffer in either being overwhelmed by their suffering, kind of taking it on. I think of, sometimes how parents feel when something happens for their child, a little bit overwhelmed in a way. There can be that, because there's such a wish for them to be happy that it reflects back on them somehow. Do you know what I mean? So I tried to come up with an example where I can put it out there to give you a sense of this quality without that feeling of either aversion or having to fix. To just let an experience be there, and I'll say more about this in a minute, to let the experience be there without having to fix it to have a particular result. The movement of compassion does have a movement of wanting to act, but it is the heart that is not resisting or wanting doesn't need to have a particular outcome of that action. So there's a movement to want to alleviate the suffering, but it's not invested in accomplishing anything in particular. So the example I came up with was imagine going into the bedroom of a child that you that you're very fond of, either daughter or son, or or grandchild, or niece or nephew, or a child of a friend. Going into the bedroom of that child and seeing them lying on their bed sobbing, and asking them, well, "What's wrong? What's going on?" And you find out that the reason they're sobbing is because they've been reading a book, and a character in the book that they've been reading has died. So there's that, that kind of sense of understanding their suffering, but without really having to do anything. It's much more about letting them experience what they're experiencing. But the action of comforting, and this happened to me when I was a child. I was reading Charlotte's Web, and Charlotte dies toward the end of this book. And my mom came into my room, and I was just so distraught. I was just completely sobbing. I was just so unhappy. And my mom's response was, "You just need to keep reading." Keep reading. But I can envision her having that kind of little sense of, a sense of, I hope that you can hold this suffering, and I hope that you can learn from it and be with it. So I'm trying to put an example out there where there's not a lot of, yeah, charge, that's a good word. So there's not a lot of charge to this example, just to give you a flavor of that quality of compassion, that there's a sense of wanting to help, and yet there's not a kind of a stickiness to it. When it gets to that stickiness, it can be in a couple of ways. There can be that feeling of overwhelm, going into a hospital where a child is deathly ill. There can be a kind of a feeling of overwhelm by the not only by their suffering but your own suffering related to it. So not a sense of balance around it. So it can have that quality of overwhelm. It can also have the quality kind of more of pity, where there's a sense of, thank God it's not me, but a wish that, a sense of wanting to help, but still with this little bit of, it's not completely open-hearted, because there's a sense of self-other, a sense of, you're the one that's suffering, I can help you, I can fix it, something like that. So I'm just trying to give you a little flavor of the territory of these emotions and where it kind of veers off from just the open-hearted connection. When that open-hearted quality, open-hearted connection meets a sense of something that is worth appreciating, somebody accomplishing good fortune, when someone has good fortune or sense of that things are going really well for somebody, when that open heart meets that, there's the feeling of sympathetic joy. And I think last week I used the analogy of liking the term sympathetic for this, because it resonates with the term sympathetic vibration in music, where if you have two strings next to each other and you pluck one of them, that the one nearby will resonate kind of in harmony with it, even though it hasn't been physically plucked. And it's kind of like that with the mudita, that when you see joy, when the heart is open and not resisting and not holding on, when there is joy or success or good fortune, the heart feels happy for that person, just in a very natural, resonant way. It's like, and a good example for this is like babies. Babies are really great example, mudita teachers. They really help us to connect with that, because again, there's not a sense of the baby taking something away from me. At least for me, babies are good this way. You know, it's like watching a child learn to accomplish something and the joy that they experience in that. You know, a little two-year-old learning how to walk over rough surface on the playground, you know, and the joy that they experience, the laughter, the happiness of being able to accomplish it. One friend of mine, when her daughter was about that age, she said there was a little lump on the playground, and you know, her daughter tried over and over again and fell down a bunch of times to try to go over this lump, and finally she could do it over and over again, and she took such joy in that accomplishment. And even just in hearing her tell the story, I felt joy, you know, just the sense of happiness for their happiness, happiness for the happiness of others. Now again, this can get skewed by wanting something back. You know, well, I'll be happy for you if you'll, or there's just a little bit of a sense of you know, holding, of wanting. Or there can be that sense of, I wish that was happening for me. You know, when we see that a friend has, you know, just fallen in love with the perfect person for them, you know, it's like, well, that's great for you, but boy, I sure wish that would happen for me. You know, so just the kind of comparison that happens. Again, that's where it moves out of the realm of the purity of the quality. So that's the first three. The last one of equanimity is the quality basically of the balanced mind, the mind that doesn't react. So it is imbues the other three when they are balanced. When there is no reactivity, when there's no either wanting the happiness of others or wanting to get rid of the suffering of others, when there's just the balance of being able to meet the experience without reactivity, that balance is equanimity. That is the ability of the heart to meet suffering without getting lost in it or wanting to get rid of it. It's the ability of the heart to meet joy without wanting more of it or feeling a sense of loss because somebody else has something that we want. So the quality of metta is the balance that underlies. And when that balance is there, the heart is more fully able to meet both pain, sorrow, and joy. So I want to talk a little bit now about exploring these qualities. Just having spent some time hopefully giving you a sense of what these qualities are, ways to begin to practice them, to cultivate them, to recognize them. So the most common way to cultivate these qualities in particular is through a formal practice. And I'll talk a little bit about that, but that's not the main thrust of what I want to talk about today. And if we're thinking about cultivating beautiful qualities, there's kind of roughly two ways to go about it. There's the way of actively engaging in practices that support that quality, which would be kind of the formal practice of or the mindfulness of. And I'll talk about those in a moment. Then there's also the noticing what gets in its way. So noticing when we're not feeling that and exploring that. So the opposite of the quality of open-hearted connectedness is when we feel closed, tight, when we feel a sense of ill will. That's the kind of the opposite quality. So exploring that quality, because there's one thing that's so amazing about these beautiful qualities is that they naturally result as the heart lets go of the opposite. So studying ill will and getting familiar with ill will and not resisting ill will, it does a couple things. I mean, it cultivates the kindness towards the ill will. So we're kind of cultivating that sense of kindness towards something that's difficult in ourselves. And it also helps us to understand that pattern of ill will in ourselves. And the understanding of that through mindfulness begins to help it to fall apart. And as it falls apart, there's more place, more room for the kindness to be there. So those two basic movements of looking at what is in the way of the quality or kind of the opposite of the quality, and also looking at how do we cultivate the quality directly. So I'll talk a little bit about each of these. In our daily lives, one of the best ways to go about cultivating these qualities is to begin to recognize them, to learn to get familiar with them, which is partly why I was exploring them with you. You know, what do they feel like? What do these qualities feel like? So noticing when these qualities are present, when there is a sense of open-hearted connection, when there is a sense of resonating at the happiness of others, when there is this sense of connection to suffering but not resistance to it, when there is a sense of balance of mind, getting familiar with these qualities and recognizing them, actually turning the mindful attention to them as they arise, exploring what does it feel, what does this quality actually feel like? Sometimes when we're mindful and when we're exploring our experience with mindfulness, we're more focused outward on what's happening in the world than we are on what's how our mind and body are resonating with what's happening. So you might, you know, meet a friend and be really happy to see them and kind of excited about talking to them and finding out what's going on and hearing the stories. There might be, you know, some good things going on for them. And if you're caught in the story, you may not notice that there's actually this quality of happiness and joy going on. So to begin to keep track of how we resonate when we are meeting our friends, when we're meeting people that we resonate with, that we connect with, begin to explore how it feels. So mindfulness of these qualities, mindfulness of kindness, of compassion, of joy and of equanimity will cultivate them. It will support their growth. Then there are ways to actively cultivate the quality, finding ways to incline the mind towards these qualities. And for each of these, there is a kind of a formal meditative practice that supports their cultivation. And it's a practice of intention. It's a practice of connecting with the wish, whether you actually actively feel it or not, stating the intention to yourself. May you be happy. May you be healthy. May you be safe. May you be at ease. These are the classic wishes for metta, for kindness. So, you know, if you want to explore the quality of loving kindness formally, you can sit down and just bring up somebody in your mind, you starting perhaps with yourself, and expressing these phrases, these wishes of kindness towards yourself, or bringing up a person, another person in your mind, and expressing the wishes or phrases of kindness to that person. The way this works is through the aspect of intention. That what's happening when you state that phrase, may you be happy, if you're saying it and understanding the meaning of it, there's a way that you are connecting with the intention or the wish for either yourself or another person to be happy. That intention is like planting a seed. It's like planting a seed of kindness. Whether you're feeling it or not, it's planting that seed, and the continued well-wishing is almost like watering that seed. You're planting more seeds and watering them simultaneously. And slowly, because of that intention, the intention is a very powerful force in our minds. One thing that one phrase that the Buddha uses that I find very powerful is, whatever you frequently ponder, that will become the inclination of your mind. If you frequently ponder thoughts of goodwill, the mind inclines in that direction. If you frequently ponder thoughts of anger and aversion, the mind inclines towards more of that. So the act of consciously wishing well begins to slowly incline the mind towards that quality. To me, when I practiced this There was one retreat where I did this metta practice for a whole month. That's all I did, was say these phrases of metta for a whole month, both to myself and to other people. And I began to have a sense or a feeling that just that initial saying of the phrase, and one way to explore this, when you say the phrase, is to come back and check in the area of the heart and see what has happened as a result of making that wish. So make the wish, may you be happy, or may I be happy, and then come back and see what has happened in the area of the heart. And what I found in my own experience was that initially I might be in a state of, you know, kind of grinchiness and bad mood, and make that wish, come back and see how has it impacted the heart. And I might feel just a subtle little kind of opening or a little bit of releasing. And then the next phrase was like opening a little more and releasing a little more. And the next phrase was opening and releasing a little more. And it was almost like that first seed was like this tiny little ember of kindness. And each subsequent phrase was blowing gently on that ember until it could begin to actually grow and could just be this more gentle warmth suffusing the experience. So the inclining the mind and noticing how the heart responds as you do that. The other three have similar practices, and I'm just going to offer you the phrases for those. For compassion practice, it's very simple. May you be free from the suffering. May you be free from your suffering. Sometimes in people exploring the compassion practice, they find some resistance to that phrase, particularly for people who are in extreme suffering or perhaps a terminal illness where there may not be an end in this life to this suffering. So another phrase that sometimes helps is that if you find that there's a kind of a resistance to may you be free from the suffering, I care about your suffering, or may you hold your suffering with ease. May you be at ease around your suffering. Something along those lines too. Sometimes people feel like when you make the wish, may you be free from your suffering, if it doesn't feel like it's possible, that there's a kind of a barrier there. The phrase for mudita, for sympathetic joy, is may your happiness continue. May your good fortune grow and become abundant. Something along those lines. Just wishing the good fortune will continue and grow. Again, just a single phrase. For equanimity practice, the classical phrase is sometimes hard to understand, but I'll give you the classical phrase and then we can explore it a little bit. The classical phrase for equanimity is you are the owner of your karma. Your happiness or unhappiness depends upon your actions, not upon my wishes for you. So basically this is a recognition that everybody has to make their own choices. We can't make people's choices for them. And so, you know, the cultivation of these things is, it's wishing outwards for people to be happy, to be free from suffering, to be joyful. But the quality that's being cultivated in us is the ability to resonate with that. And with equanimity, it's not so much that we're wishing them equanimity as we are exploring our own ability to be balanced around whatever choices people make. So, the classic or a way of thinking about this or exploring this would be how to have equanimity about a child's choices, you know, as they've turned into an adult and you're watching them make their choices, really wanting them to be happy, wishing for them to be happy, and yet, you know, a sense of seeing that, oh, I see you're making bad choices, wrong choices, you know, you got to fix this, you got to change this, you need to do that. This is kind of a counter to that movement. So your happiness or unhappiness depends upon your actions, depends upon the choices that you make. So another phrase that sometimes people use for this one is, I wish you happiness but cannot make your choices for you. All beings have their own journey. May you make skillful choices on your journey, or something like that. So that's cultivating these qualities more actively. And it can also be interesting to find ways to do this creatively in your daily life. At one point, I chose every time I went into the Safeway to be a time when I would practice metta to whoever I saw. To just keep that well-wishing going. And it really made going into the Safeway a lovely experience. do this at airports, It might turn into compassionate practice in airports, A lot of suffering in airports. Or mudita sometimes, when you see people getting together, people meeting their loved ones that they haven't seen for a while, just kind of feeling how the quality of being open-hearted in connection shifts and changes as it either sees someone who's really struggling and suffering or sees someone who's really happy. So beginning to notice this flow of these feelings. Just being creative, being playful around cultivating these qualities. And then there's the looking at what gets in their way. If you're really noticing not the quality of kindness, but the quality of I wish I had, or the feeling of that zero-sum game, if that's what's happening, is the feeling of contraction is strongest, turning the attention to that with a heart of kindness, with a heart of compassion, being able to be compassionate with ourselves, with our inability to be compassionate, with our inability to be loving, that this is where it begins. We can't simply expect ourselves to suddenly, just because we think and hear about these things and think this would be a good idea, we can't expect our habits of mind to suddenly turn on a dime and change. We really have to work with our habits, our patterns of mind, and be compassionate about them. It's not as if, we would turn them off if we could. It's not as if we're really, there's some not self going on with these habits and patterns. They are the conditioned nature of our minds, and we can't just say, okay, that conditioning had enough of that. It doesn't work that way. The way through the conditioning is to meet it with compassion, with kindness. So turning towards those feelings when we find in this practice of exploring these qualities, when we find the clinging or the aversion, just, there's some of that clinging aversion. Can we just turn and meet that? And as that starts to fall away and loosen, we'll find more and more ability to be open-hearted and connecting. So both sides both actively cultivating and looking at what gets in its way, support the cultivation for these qualities to become more predominant in our lives. Then there's another way to explore, I think it's a reflective practice. Kind of this, and I'll talk about it a little bit because it can be a helpful way to kind of get a sense for yourself of what would be a helpful way to explore this for yourself. You know, using your own intuition, your own knowledge and wisdom to find ways to navigate through this terrain. So a reflective practice is a way of, and I think I've talked about it in this meeting before, but I'm going to just remind you about it. A reflective practice is a way to think about something from a meditative perspective so that we're opening ourselves to actually think about content, but staying connected with our experience and watching what happens for us. So I'm going to describe the kind of framework for the practice. It's helpful often to start with some time of just meditation, just settling in. Before you go into that meditation, it's helpful to have a question in your mind that you want to explore. For these, you may have a question, something. It may simply be first just exploring what is metta? Or what is compassion? So just starting, having an idea in your mind of what the question you'd want to explore. And then bringing yourself into a meditative space for some period of time. And after, say, 5 minutes or 7 minutes of settling, you know, when you feel like you've settled a little bit, drop the question into the meditation. And then pay attention to what happens. Don't think about the question. Drop in the question. Notice how that question, it's like dropping a pebble into a still pool. You see there are ripples out from making that action. When we put a thought into our mind, there are ripples that happen. So noticing those ripples, they may be subtle, they may be obvious. Those ripples may include thoughts, they may include emotions, they may include body sensations. But if they do include thoughts, just notice the thoughts that have arisen. Don't follow them. So just notice what arises. Kind of use it as a mindfulness practice. You're basically orienting your mindfulness around a theme, dropping in this question into your mindfulness practice, and then just being mindful of what happens for, say, 2 or 3 minutes, and then drop the question in again to help you stay focused on the question so that you don't end up getting pulled out into thought. So keeping coming back to the question. Do that for, say, 10 minutes. And then at the end of that time, the way I like to suggest people work with this is to, at that point, after you've had a period of reflection, write down what you noticed. Just write it down. I wouldn't think about it too much at that point. I'd do it for a couple days, just writing down what you've noticed. And then after a few days, go back and read what you've written and actively reflect, think about what you've noticed. So would you like to try that reflective practice, or would you like to ask questions? Go either way. Are there any questions? Are there any? Okay. Use the mic. It's on the floor.
Wondering if asking what the barriers are to these qualities, if that is a good question.
That sounds like a great question. Yeah, I mean, you may not know, And, you know, asking that question may start to bring up a sense in you that, you know, there's a lot of wisdom in there. And when we think about things, it can mask some of that wisdom. So just dropping in that question and being open to what comes up. So you might drop in the question, what are the barriers to kindness? And then you might feel a feeling of fear. Okay, just notice the fear. Hang out with that feeling of fear for, you know, a couple minutes. It may dissipate. Drop the question in again. You may get something completely different. So, yeah, just keep exploring. And creativity with these questions. This practice is incredibly, I don't know what the right word is. I was going to say generic, but it's not the right word. it's very widely applicable. You can use it if you are wondering about how to approach a difficult situation. You know, in your life, you can use it to help make decisions. There's lots of applications for this because, you know, when we think about things, we often are, you know, we're so much in our views and opinions when we're engaging in our thoughts that we can kind of just run around in circles. And this opens us up to a kind of a wellspring of more intuitive knowledge. So this is a really excellent technique to bring into daily life practice. So yeah, those sound like great questions, and get really creative about the questions. Tanya, did you have something?
I guess I was just thinking about Jack Kornfield's book, The Forgiveness One, and his instructions for equanimity practice, which kind of are like loving kindness practice. He says, "May I be safe," or wait, that's the loving kindness. But may I learn to see the rising and falling of all things with equanimity and balance. Mm-hmm. Sort of, there's three steps. That's the sort of middle step. And I practiced that for a couple of years. And, of course, that last piece, the next piece in his is what you said about, you know, may I learn to see that, how did it go? But the suffering and the joy of what other people choose is their choice.
Yes.
But I was wondering about the difference between that middle piece and the last piece.
I guess, you know, thinking about just now, I'm not sure what Jack had in mind. As I think about it now, it's the middle one is less personal. So it may be easier to be balanced around things that are impersonal than to be balanced around where there's, you know, interchange and interaction. Yeah.
Would it be wrong to use that for this coming election for a political decision?
You can use it for any kind of decision.
I've been really confused lately, and, you know, whether I believe or not believe or give my opinions or have misguided opinions. And I, as you were talking, I thought it didn't seem right that I would use that way, but I think it might, the question one by one, especially with the propositions also.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, connect in your heart with how, I mean, that it's funny with the spiritual practice, we think, you know, we have these ideas about what should be outside of that practice. And this practice is much more about really connecting with what is happening all through our day, all through our lives. It's not really simply about sitting down and being silent and going inward and becoming calm and concentrated. It's really about learning to meet everything that happens. And beginning to understand what our delusions are, what our confusions are, what our beliefs are, where their beliefs, you know, that we have so many beliefs that are unexamined. So everywhere in our lives, all the choices we make, it's worth bringing mindfulness to and examining what's going on. So use it in that way.
You know, like the Buddha said, when they asked him a statement of what he is, I am awake. And it's that awakeness to even be awake for you to even have the intention, you know, to do these things. Because like when you're off, it's that whole thing, you know, it's rather immense, like you say, in the inner process, the outer process. But it's, you know, that willingness and that attitude to, when you've been away, to self-correct, bring yourself back. And it's a full plate.
What do you mean by a full plate? What do you say more?
Well, there's always an opportunity to practice and to be mindful. I mean, there's, in a sense, there's no, like, time out, so to speak.
Yeah, yeah. You know, that sometimes it can feel like, do I ever get a break?
but you got to let go of that, too. You know, I mean, it's like, wow, what did I get myself into? You know, it's like, but you know, what else is there better to do, really?
That's exactly what I feel like has happened for me. You know, it's like, there's just such a sense of this engagement with moment-to-moment experience having so clearly shifted my life. You know, it's like, what better is there to do with my life than to meet whatever is happening? And it is a big thing. I mean, the biggest part or the hardest part initially is the incredible momentum away. You know, that our minds have such a strong habit of momentum out, away from awake, that when we wake up and realize we're in the middle of that momentum, it's hard to stay present for it. I came up with this analogy recently. It's like, you know, it's like learning how to ride a wild horse. You know, that's the way our minds are. But we can actually learn how to, you know, meet that energy of that expansion out and be mindful of it. Learn how to ride the wild horse of our habits. That's the pure mindfulness approach, essentially. You know, to kind of see, can you have the mindfulness ride the back of whatever energy it has woken up into? You know, it might be, you know, an explosion of anger, you know, and just, oh, there I am, waking up into this explosion of anger. Initially, that can be really challenging. You know, initially, learning how to do that, riding the wild horse. I mean, the horse is pretty much more powerful than the mindfulness is. So, you know, you get thrown off. You know? The horse just runs rampant. So there need to be some correctives, perhaps, you know, consciously, okay, let that go, come back to something grounded, come back to the breathing. There it is again. Can I let it go? Come back to the breathing. So that, you know, initially there needs to be that kind of movement. But over time, we can learn to actually be present for the kind of initial movement out, that initial movement towards that energetic horse, the wild horse feeling. And we can just be there with it. And in meeting that energy, it's like the horse becomes tame almost immediately. And whew. And so the over time, what I find happens is that habit out, the kind of strong energy that pulls us away gets much less strong. And so it's much easier in waking up in the midst of some thought of something. It's like, oh, that's a thought, you know. And then we're back. So the waking up into something is the coming back. There's nothing to come back to. So we wake up into, oh, there's a, boy, I'm thinking about what that person did wrong. Oh, there's some anger. Oh, there it's gone. That can take some time, but the practice of being willing to engage with whatever and learning about that, the wild patterns of our mind, it slowly begins to tame them just through that meeting, just through the meeting. And through sometimes recognizing, well, that horse is really out of control. I can't even begin to get on that one. So let me just, you know, come back to my breath or come back to my feet on the ground to really allow that, not to try to stop that wild horse from doing its thing, but to just not put attention there. Because the attention, the non-mindful attention to those things gives them strength. Yeah.
Sangha is so important, the support that we get here to be able to connect with one another, and to it's such a refuge to have Sangha. And there's such a difference in people that are practicing and people who aren't consciously practicing. So it's just so nice and so sweet to, you know, come in and to be, you know, here, you know, and to do what we're doing, you know. I find that just so precious, and I'm so grateful for it.
It's an amazing gift.
Yeah.
Amen. Anything else? Why don't we sit for the last 2 minutes? I'll do this reflective practice next week. We'll talk about it a little bit. We'll have more time for that next week. So let's just sit. Thank you.